In fact, for a very, very long time, I wished I wasn't a girl because of the cultural restrictions I had. I'm Dr. Nagat. I'm an NHS GP and I also run a private practice. And I have been for the last 16 years a doctor. I'm a specialist in women's health. And he said to me, why do you want to become a doctor? And I just looked at him and I just went, because it's my only route to freedom. And because it's the only way that I'm going to get people to take me seriously if I have a doctor in front of my name. And the surgeon on the panel looked at me and he said, that's the only honest answer we've had all day. Women are so beautiful. The fact that our brains are so intrinsically linked with our gynecologically, and we just don't trust women enough to be able to sort of say to them, yeah, you are right.
The obsession of getting married, this achievement and this badge of honor that we're told that is, you're complete.
Yeah.
I think it's rubbish.
Okay, let me flip that then. Your purpose is that you're the rich man. Happiness comes from you, not your other half. The fact that you are able to be satisfied with what you're doing, the fact that you want to make some change comes from you, not your marriage.
Exactly.
And I think that that's fundamentally, if you distill all that down, is because we're still not ready for women to be their own person.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to another episode of A Millennial Mind. Before we get into this podcast, I want to tell you all about my weekly live Sunday workshops. A lot of people ask how I was able to quit the corporate rat race and do something that I love every single day, and that's by working on myself and doing so many different things to do with my self-development. So every Sunday, I host a workshop focusing on different topics from manifesting to the law of attraction to goal setting to how I manage my time, and you can join too. There's a 3-day free trial. I'll leave the link in the comments, but for now, let's get into the episode. Dr. Nagat, welcome to Millennial Mind.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. This feels like a long time coming.
It does, doesn't it?
I have stalked you for a very long time. I literally have stalked you.
I love it. Well, I have learned so much from you. So I want to learn more from you today. I feel like there's going to be a sex ed lesson for me, which I so desperately need. If you've all watched my podcast, you'll know I really know nothing. Much to the surprise of when you showed me this, I was like, what is that? A vagina? And you were like, oh my God, you really need a sex ed lesson. So welcome to sex ed. If you were sleeping during school like me, we're here today to discuss. But
we're going to talk about sort of anatomy as well, which is just normal anatomy. And that, just so for anybody really quickly, is a anatomy of your uterus and your fallopian tubes and your ovaries and your vagina. So it's the gross anatomy of your gynecological bits.
Which I know nothing about, so very excited for this. But for people who don't know who you are, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm Dr. Nagat. I'm an NHS GP and I also run a private practice. And I have been for the last 16 years a doctor. And I'm a specialist in women's health. I'm also the ambassador for Wellbeing of Women and the resident doctor on BBC Breakfast and ITV's This Morning, which is great fun. I've published a book. I'm the author of my first debut book, which is actually best-selling at the moment.
Amazing.
Which is called The Knowledge, Your Guide to Female Health from Menstruation to the Menopause. And I've written articles for British Vogue, Red Magazine. And in 2023, I got an award from the Prime Minister for my work around women's health, particularly for ethnic minority communities. And currently, just the last thing that I'm doing and working on is the women's health strategy. And part of that is something called the Health Collective, which is mapping all grassroots marginalised groups that are doing the work already with those communities to build trust so that when we come to writing clinical pathways, that we have equitable healthcare.
Okay. Well, you know, people always ask me why I don't do the introductions, and that's really why, because there's no way I'd be able to remember this like long list of achievements. It's honestly amazing, amazing what you've done.
You just
done
need to remember she's a doctor, and that's it. That's all you need to remember.
Well, that's what your parents probably say. They're just like, she's a doctor. I've won the gene lottery of children.
Actually, I should always say the best thing out of all of that is that I'm a mum to three boys. Before even I'm a doctor, I should just say, just because they'll probably listen to this
and be like, hello.
My sister's a huge fan of yours, as you already know.
So sweet.
So I am also the sister to five siblings.
Yeah, crazy. I can't believe you're like one of six. I'm just like,
it's a big family.
Massive. Yeah. I want to talk around, you know, obviously it's probably your parents' lifelong dream for you to become a GP, and obviously your lifelong dream to become a GP, I'm sure, and I'm just joking. When did you know you wanted to become a GP? Or doctor, sorry, should I say?
I knew I wanted to become a doctor really early doors, because when I was about 15, 16, I went to my career teacher at school at the Misbourne, and I said to him, what's the longest degree I can do? And he just went, okay, it's either going to be vets. And I was like, I don't like animals. Or the other thing is I can be a doctor. And that's a 5 to 6 year degree. And I was like, I will do that. Because the expectation was, and the background to that is because the expectation was I'll get married. I come from a really traditional household. My father is the imam. So we are very conservative in our way of upbringing. And my parents had this expectation. So in Islam, your parents have two things for you. One is to obviously get you to sort of become a human being and be a humanitarian. And the second thing is to get you married so that you can go and have kids and spread Islam. So it's fads to marry your children off. And I just decided that actually that's not what I want. I didn't want to be shackled at home and having lots and lots of children. So I thought education would be my freedom, my key to freedom. And at a really young age, I just loved reading and getting myself educated. And for that, I thought there's two ways. One is that I suppose you could call it that was my rebellion as a teenager. I'll just go and get an education.
Love
because
it.
Because the alternative was to be, you know, an at-home mum and have children. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, there's lots of... My mother's a housewife and she's an amazing seamstress. So she's learnt the skill to sew clothes, etc. Wow. It's just that wasn't for me. I knew that there was a bigger, wider world out there and education was the stepping stone to getting to there.
And were your parents okay with you being educated and studying for
so long?
I don't
think at the time they knew that this was going to be the thing that it had become. My dad was quite happy if I just become a nurse or a teacher and that's about it. And then it's only when I got my first interview. So I got places at two universities. One was Southampton University and the other was Queen Mary's University, Barts and the London. It's only when the interview letter came through the door and it was titled... Mr. Arif. So my dad opened it thinking it was for him. And then it was actually a letter that they mistyped the front of the letter. And then he opened it up and he picked me up from school and he goes, apparently I have an interview at Barts and the London Medical School. Do you know anything about this? And I was like, oh my God, I got an interview.
Where did you live at the time?
I lived in Chesham. I still live in Chesham.
Right, okay.
And said to my parents, I'm going to go off to London. And it was one of those things that none of us had ever gone to London in our family, ever. And so...
It's not that far, though. It's like 40 minutes, no?
It's 40 minutes. But, you've got to think back. This is 2002. And
right.
My parents never took us out of Cheshire, never went on a train, nothing.
Wow.
And this is before the time of sat-navs and Google Maps, etc.
True, yeah.
So I sat at school and I sort of sat with my teacher, learnt how to get the train. And I said to my mum, I need a suit. I only had shalwar kameez at the time. And my mum went out and from a secondhand shop, I brought some Zara trousers. I remember that. And I brought a silk, grey silk Marks and Spencer shirt with a grey blazer or a black Marks and Spencer's blazer, all secondhand because I was just like, I don't know what's going to work. And my brother, who was 16 at the time, and I was 17, both of us, when we got lost, we asked lots of people, but I had loads of time and I arrived there an hour early. And this is how stupid I am. The silk shirt, basically, I sweated through it. So I was in the changing rooms and I thought, right, I'll go to the toilet just to freshen up before I go for my interview. Took my blazer jacket off, sweat down the shirt. And then I was just like, okay, this is why it was in a secondhand shop.
First of all, you shouldn't say you're stupid because I think, like, that's not stupid. You know, you didn't know. Why would
I didn't
know that?
Exactly. And so then I just put my blazer back on and it's in the summer. So they do all the interviews in the summer. It was blistering heat. But it was amazing. It was like the first time I'd ever had this sort of level of freedom. And wow. I did my interview, came out, and it was all the other people at the interview room were from grammar schools and from private schools and had come with their parents and, you know, really well to do. And I just was there with my brother, sort of having to find our way and navigate around London, sort of completely lost as two kids were at the time.
Oh my God,
that was
amazing. That is such an amazing story because I do think we sometimes take for granted how easy transport is now or how accessible it is and how I can literally go onto Google and be like, how do I get there? And it'll tell me all the lines.
Yeah.
You're right. Back then, how would you know how to use a train? How would you know how to get to the station? How would you know where to stop? Where would you know it was confusing.
Absolutely. And we borrowed a Nokia phone from a family friend so that I could phone home to the landline. And that was the only number I remembered to let my mum know where I was. And honestly, we were so naive, me and my brother, on how to travel. But it was the best thing ever because I was going off to go and do medicine. And in the medical interview, I thought I completely like ruined it because there was a surgeon, there was a medical student, and there was also, you know, a consultant physician. And he said to me, why do you want to become a doctor? And I just looked at him and I just went sweating through my clothes. You know, I'm like this sweaty Pakistani girl sitting in front of him. He's a bit chubby and I still am a bit chubby. And I just looked at him and I just said, because it's my only route to freedom. And because it's the only way that I'm going to get people to take me seriously if I have a doctor in front of my name. And the surgeon on the panel looked at me and he said, that's the only honest answer we've had all day.
Amazing.
And I just thought to myself, I've got this one shot and I just need to be really honest about why I'm here. And I will work my damnedest because you need a goal and you need a purpose. And my purpose was to kick back at the patriarchy.
Good for you.
I know.
That sounds really huge. Good for you. I'm literally just like, wow, this is amazing. I like was welling up and then you just gave me this like empowerment, strong vibe. So like that is so amazing. Round of applause actually right now. I wish we had like a studio we could do this. That is unbelievable. I think that, so like, look, my opening statement of like every parent wants their child to be educated and be a doctor is false because actually that's not the same for every parent, is it?
It isn't. And I think especially if you're a girl. So they say in life you get two beatings, either metaphorically, someone really puts you down, or physically. And there's a happy story to this. And I did get that beating. And I used to really want to go to school. I came to the UK when I was 9 years old and I didn't speak any English. And my father had said to my mother, don't worry, we're going to England. It's an island. So you're thinking it's the Caribbean and it's beautiful and there's beaches and it's green. And so my mother, who was a bit of a princess, she'd grown up on a farm, etc. And so we're subsidy farmers back in Pakistan. So we're near Lahore in Multan is actually where I grew up. And to her, to come to England was going to be this huge adventure. And we thought it was only going to be temporary. So I came in my little summer dress. And there's a picture of me coming out of Heathrow where I'm wearing flip-flops and a summer dress. And it was pouring it down. It was so wet and rainy. My mother was mortified. We all got colds and a chesty infection within 2 or 3 days of being in the UK. But in Pakistan, I was the first girl after a number of boys. So I had lots of cousins and I just wasn't sent to school. It was just something that wasn't seen. The nearest school was about a mile away. And once I snuck up after my cousins and I really wanted to follow them. So I went after them and one of my uncles brought me back and my grandmother beat me. And I remember that. You remember that at the age of like five, you know, 6 or 7. And she was just like, I'd be mortified if anything happened to you. Someone's going to kidnap you. And my dad was in England working. What am I going to say to your father if he comes home and you've been kidnapped? So the gender sort of limitations that I had. And I just remember going, I wish I wasn't a girl. In fact, for a very, very long time, I wished I wasn't a girl because of the cultural restrictions I had. Not because of Islam. Islam doesn't give you any restrictions. It says educate your girls just as equally as you would your boys. I think it's the cultural barriers that we have for women. And for me, it was always like, how can I get past this? How can I get past this? And my gender is not a hindrance.
Honestly, that is so amazing. I'm just like in awe and in shock that like you've just escaped this rat race of like you will never achieve anything if you're a woman. Because I think that obviously I grew up in the UK and whilst there were cultural differences in what my brothers and I could do, it wasn't necessarily around education. Education has always been at the forefront of my parents' mind. Sure, they've told me to cook more and sure, they've told me I have to be at home more. And obviously now that's all changing because I advocate for the complete opposite.
Yeah.
And only they support me because they see that I have support. But education is such a fundamental part of our life. So how did you reverse that? Because fair enough, I can say to my parents, like, okay, don't tell me to cook and tell Akshay not to cook. I just won't cook.
Yeah.
But to say to them, no, I want to go to school, I'm going to go and study, that's in their hands, no?
My parents were really liberal-minded. My dad, obviously, he ran a congregation, so we lived and breathed and grew up in the mosque. My mother actually was still the strongest woman that I know, because she fought back a lot of the mindset of the community. So just to give you an example, for me to go to university, my parents were really scared of what the community would say. You know, the imam's daughter is going to mosque, oh my God, going to university, oh my God, she might smile. She might drink, she might run off with somebody. And actually, my mother was the strongest person and said, if the congregation don't want to follow us because of this, then that's fine. And that's quite strong to go against what is the cultural norm, which is to keep your daughters at home and marry them.
What's an imam?
A priest.
Okay, I don't know that. Sorry.
That's okay. So my father is the Muslim leader for the Sunni Muslims in the whole of Buckinghamshire.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay, so that's why there was so much pressure.
Yeah, there was. I am literally the priest's daughter.
My God. That's why I was like, wait, what? What does that mean? I'm so confused. Wow.
So, yes, of course. So just like you have a pandit in Hinduism, or you have a clergyman or the bishop. My father is the longest serving imam in the whole of the UK. He's been the same imam for 41 years in Buckinghamshire. And we serve and we look after the Sunni community. And he's got an MBE for his services to Islam.
Wow,
yeah, I'm really, really proud of him. I'm incredibly proud of him.
That's so lovely.
And I think that to have parents who are so forward-thinking means that the biggest thing is that my parents at the age of sort of when we started at the age of 15, 16, 17, we weren't Pakistani anymore. We'd become more westernized. And integration is a huge part of that. Yes. So actually the mindset had to change. So I would always say I have one camp in sort of my Pakistani household and one camp in a very British lifestyle. And how do you get those two sides of you to not fight each other constantly? So it's the fact that if I go home, it's not like, Mum, cook whatever curry you want to cook because I'm going to stink the minute I leave the house, to the point where actually I'm comfortable if I stink of curry at school. And those sort of issues that we had growing up, how comfortable am I going to be wearing a hijab? How comfortable am I going to be going into, say, a professional meeting wearing shalwar kameez, which is my traditional attire? How comfortable am I going to be in my own skin as a woman of colour and be able to share things that are my cultural norms, but completely alien to say to a white population that I might be speaking to. And I think that comes from our parents leading the way. My siblings are incredible. I've got a brother who's a criminal law barrister, another brother who's a chartered accountant, my sister who's a dentist, and my youngest brother, Ali, who's a pediatrician, who's a pediatric nurse.
Oh my gosh.
And so, yeah, we did win the lottery as kids.
All five of you? That's bizarre. There's has to be one who's like, didn't do anything. Oh, wow.
No, I'm incredibly proud. And I think that the whole point of all of us going through this was the fact that we stuck together as siblings and we still see each other regularly. And then we also made sure that integration happened so that there wasn't this internal battle. And not, don't get me wrong, there always is. You know, where's my place as a hijab-wearing doctor in the NHS in the UK? The pandemic put a mirror up to that. So you try and see, right, what can I do to fit in but also be unique as well?
Yes.
There's that, so there is that internal struggle that you have. And now that I'm 40, I think I'm really comfortable where I am. Like this podcast has come at a really great time because I feel like all those angst that I had as younger Nigat, I don't have anymore. I've got to the point where I basically don't give a shit. Sorry.
Love it. No, please swear.
Like that, I've got to the point where I'm just like, okay, I've got all the accolades. Because when you're younger, you just think, for people to take me seriously, I'll just get lots of degrees.
Yes.
I'll get another degree. I'll get another degree. I'll get another title behind my name. I'll play the game. I'll get married. And then everybody will be like, oh, well, she's successful because she's got married and had to appease my community at the same time. Because if you're a professional woman and you haven't got married, it doesn't matter how accolades you get in your career, you're just not married.
Yeah.
And then if you're a married woman and you haven't had kids, God forbid, then again, you're a failure as a, you know, your fertility defines all that. And so I thought to myself, well, I'll do all of this. And it came to the age of 40 and the pandemic hit and I realized, do you know what? You do everything for everybody else to keep everybody else happy. Where's you in the middle of all that? So this is where I've got to the point where I just am being and yes. enjoying where I am.
I resonate so much with your point around people think you're nothing without marriage.
Oh, and that, you know, that is the single most thing that makes me swear quite a lot.
Oh,
and
me
I
too.
Get so angry at that. And the thing is that it's basically rooted in the fact that it's defining and showing girls, not so much boys, I feel, but girls particularly, that that's your worth. Your worth is literally just to be eye candy on the arm of somebody else, a trophy person, and then to bear them kids.
It's just that you're nothing.
But I know that
it.
That's such a radical thing to say in our culture.
But it's not, because like this, I'm very passionate about this, and I find it very frustrating because I made a reel last year and was like, stop asking women getting married, right? And it got like 6 million views, and people were like, this is such an outdated thing to say. I'm like, well, why has it got 6 million views then? Mm. If it's so outdated, why has it got that? People still say to me that you're making a big deal by saying that women's worth is more than marriage. They say to me, you know, we know that. I have pinned on my post my TED Talk, my billboard in Leicester Square, and a podcast with Stephen Bartlett. Those three pinned posts combined are not even near my engagement photo likes. Not even near it. So my billboard and me doing a TED Talk combined is less than half in terms of engagement and likes and people's support compared to me getting married, me getting engaged. And let me just say one thing. I'm very grateful and I love you all for all of your love towards me. And I know people are very happy for me and I appreciate that. What I'm saying is that my point still stands of people will be happier for me and they support me and they're really excited for me to get engaged, which I am too, by the way. I'm not against marriage, which people think I am. I just think that it took me so much more to be on a billboard in Leicester Square. Yeah. It took me so much more to do a TED Talk, but it's not recognized. And I think it's sad. And the people, I want to do a whole podcast, wasn't that we can do actually, because I think you went through a similar thing. It's like the pressure, the obsession of getting married, this achievement and this badge of honor that we're told that is, you're complete.
Yeah.
I think is rubbish.
Okay, let me flip that then. So I did that. I got the degree. I got married at a reasonable age. I got to 23 and I got married to an incredible husband and I adore him to pieces. And then, you know, 4 years later into our marriage, we didn't have a baby straight away. We got to know each other. I had an arranged marriage, so I wasn't going to run into having children. And so we wanted to get to know each other. And he's a human rights lawyer. And 4 years later, we had a son. Then we had another son. And then we got three boys. And do you know what now that I keep getting asked is, when are you going to have a daughter?
Really?
So I'll tell you that there's two things that I've learned from that. The first thing is that if you're trying to tick boxes in your life for other people, you're never going to succeed. So actually, you know, shut that door straight away. Be comfortable in that. That's why your billboard, which you work so hard for, actually doesn't get any like, because the thing is, you're still this trophy person that needs to be achieving the goals of life or the university of life.
Yes.
And so for me, I still haven't achieved that because I haven't had a daughter. So what did I do? I thought, well, do you know what? I'll make a book for my nieces. I've got two gorgeous nieces. I'll make a book all about women's health. My book doesn't get any likes or any sort of things until I put up stuff about my nieces. And I think that the thing that has taught me consistently is that when you are constantly trying to do something for yourself, unfortunately, there are individuals or the cultural norms are set up in a way where we still can't celebrate women to the degree that we would celebrate men. Men just have to sneeze and we're like, oh my God, that was an amazing sneeze, you know? And so what you have to be able to find is that, where is your purpose, and find your purpose and follow that.
Yes.
Your purpose isn't actually marriage. I know that sounds really
it's
crazy.
Not.
But okay. So
but people hate me when I say that, people think I hate him. And I'm like, I love him.
You
He's
love
the best
him.
Thing that's happened to me. I wouldn't do any of this if it wasn't without him. I just don't think that is the only thing I want to focus on in my life.
Exactly.
Because
your purpose
other things.
Isn't marriage.
It's not.
But to say that is so radical.
Yeah.
When actually, if you look at the majority of the world still, where women are reliant on men financially, it's like, that should be your purpose. Bag the richest man. And I think that, you know, Cher said it the best. She goes, well, I'm the rich man.
Yeah.
And so your purpose is that you're the rich man. Happiness comes from you, not your other half. The fact that you are able to be satisfied with what you're doing, the fact that you want to make some change comes from you, not your marriage.
Exactly.
And I think that that's fundamentally, if you distill all that down, is because we're still not ready for women to be their own person. That's it.
So true. Oh my gosh, so much I need to talk to you about. I feel like we need like a coffee though to like rant at each other.
To rant at each other, yeah.
I want to talk around your journey into the media world because not everyone gets into the media world. Not everybody wants to. Did you always want to kind of be in the media?
Oh God, no. Honestly, it was the furthest thing that I could ever have imagined. And I feel like I'm riding a wave and at any point it's going to crash. And every single gig, like even this podcast is my last gig and I'll never do another gig. And some would say that's imposter syndrome and that's insecurity. And yes, I have massive imposter syndrome. But also because I never thought that I would be in front of a camera. In 2015, my middle son was born, Kasim, and he has a rare liver condition. And he ended up getting liver cancer. And so for 3 years of my career, I was a hermit. I lived and breathed and stayed in a hospital. And it was the toughest time I could ever have. And it was really difficult. And actually, my career completely went to the wayside. And that's when you realize how much, like, medicine is, as much as I love my kids and my husband, I'm just going to caveat that. But medicine was my first love and still is my first love. The clinical medicine, seeing patients, my career, that was the thing I built. And then for no reason, the thing that I'd built had been taken away from me. And I was suddenly just a mum. Not just a mum, that sounds really sort of banal, but I was a mum looking after a really, really sick child. He had 8 operations, 4 times in ITU, twice intubated. He had septicemia. And in between all of that, I still wanted to keep on working to keep my hand in so I could get my appraisal and still stay on the career path. And through that, I found that women come to women and I started working in different practices. And so I honed in my women's health because I couldn't focus on him being so sick. So the only thing I could hone in on was the fact that the one thing I knew, which was stable, and that for me was clinical medicine. So I sort of threw myself into that gung-ho and looked after him at the same time. At the time, I also had a 4-year-old as well. And it was 2018, I'd fallen pregnant again. After all of that, I had another baby and now Adam was born. And I was breastfeeding him. And on Twitter, there was lots of conversations about menopause that was happening. And Louise Minchin on BBC Breakfast was going to talk about her menopause experience. So the BBC Breakfast was going to do a whole week of something called Wake Up to the Menopause. And I was sort of writing the fact that actually, you know, in Asian communities, menopause isn't seen the similar way. I don't get women coming in going, I've got hot flushes. I'll get women coming in with different symptoms, usually head to toe pain. Sara kosh dohde, you know, everything hurts, Dr. Nigat. Or my sir dohde, minu talaki on the, I get palpitations. They never complain of the conventional, you know, signs and symptoms I would see. So the ethnic sort of conversations that we're having aren't actually reflected in the clinical pathways that I'm meant to be practicing as an NHS doctor. So I put that on Twitter thinking, would other med Twitter people, other doctors corroborate that and say, actually, we also get Black and Asian women with different symptoms compared to their white counterparts. And they got picked up by a producer and said, and Lisa Kelly, who's still a dear friend, was a producer at the time. And Lisa said to me, do you want to come and do this on the sofa and talk about your experiences working with Black and Asian communities? And I was like, no, thank you. And I put the phone down. I was like, I'm not going on the BBC Breakfast sofa. I'm breastfeeding. I have to go all the way up to Manchester. She phones me back and she goes, we'll do your makeup and hair. And I was like, I'll be there on the next train. I was like, literally that quick.
I love it.
It was just the fact that I'm a mum at home with 2 kids.
How am I going to do it?
And if someone's going to offer to do my makeup for free, mate, I'm that easy. So I was there in the makeup chair and I was like, make me look like Kim Kardashian. You know, contour this face as much as you can.
So amazing. And did you take your babies with you?
I took my babies with me.
No.
I breastfed
way.
Him before I went on the sofa. I sat on the sofa, got off the sofa. My mother phoned me and she was like, but the means, what have you done? And I was like, what's wrong? She goes, you talked about vaginas. It wasn't even 8 o'clock yet. And this is awful. You know, we watched you from home. And what did you wear? This is all. And my mother always has either a complaint about the color of my lipstick, which is either too bright, or the fact that I wear really bright clothes. Because this is something that is so out of their norm. You shouldn't be on TV. You shouldn't be seen or heard as a Muslim woman.
Really? Is that the case? You shouldn't be seen or heard?
Well, in the cultural norms that I'm growing up in, which is quite conservative, yeah. And it was suddenly, I just thought, well, that's my last gig. I'm never going to get asked. Then come round 2020, there's this novel virus that's going around and we're all sort of freaking out in general practice. What's happening? We don't have PPE. And BBC Breakfast phones me again and says, we're looking for some doctors. Would you want to be one of the doctors and just tell us what you're doing in general practice? And I was like, well, I'm up at 6:30 in the morning. And I then ended up being the same doctor that did it for 2 years from my kitchen down the line, just talking about what we're doing from sort of no PPE. Oh, we've got PPE. Now we're seeing really sick patients. Now we've got care home residents that we're looking after. And then we started going about vaccines. And then they came out to my surgery to watch me vaccinate my patients. It was just basically the BBC just followed me. And it was a complete serendipity and a mistake and nothing that I ran after, if that makes sense. But I'm dyslexic and I can't understand really complex data. So for me, I would read loads of complex data about the virus or whatever, and I would distill it into the common denominator. And I thought, if I can understand it and I can relay this, then lots of people can understand it, then that's okay. And it was about 6 months later into the pandemic that this morning rang. And on Zoom, I had like a quick audition and they're like, right, do you want to be booked in next week? And now it's been 3 years, coming up to 3 years that I'm doing so both amazing. Of the shows. And the crazy thing is that I've always looked like this. I've always worn a hijab. I've always worn colourful like colours and stuff. But Middle England suddenly woke up to the fact that there was a woman wearing a hijab from her kitchen. And she's not going to bake me a cake, let's put it that way. And she's talking about women's health and she's talking about sort of viruses and medicine stuff. And I think that was the bit that just made me stood out, for rightly or wrongly. Mm-hmm. That sort of was my journey into mainstream media.
I feel like I want a ball.
It was really difficult because at the start, especially when I did some studio stuff, I did have those early conversations. Your hijab is just a bit too much. Would you ever think of not wearing it? And in fact, I'll tell you this.
Really?
Yeah. It.
That's not that long ago.
I know. We're only talking about 2020. And
I'm shocked at that, though.
And I think it's because, let's face it, before me, there was Nadia from Bake Off. And
yes.
She's a darling. I adore her. But there is always this thing to be sort of Western aesthetic, to be acceptable.
Yes.
And I wear it like I would do if it was a dupatta, because I'm Punjabi.
Yeah.
And so it is really noticeable. I'm not wearing it like the Kardashians are into a turban to make it a bit more acceptable. And you know that sort of a cultural appropriation that happens? And so I've kept the way that I've always been and I'm not going to change it in any way. And that sort of then offends a lot of other Muslim people because they'll be like, sister, you know, your gardan, we can see your neck. That's
right.
Haram. You know, you're wearing so much makeup. That's haram. And so it's almost like you're either not Muslim enough or you're too Muslim. And so the barometer changes again. And then it's your name is too complicated. You know, it's actually Nighat. No one's going to be able to pronounce that. So I say Nighat in English. And, you know, there were really, really early mumblings to say, well, do you want to have like a stage name and change your name? And I think like the name Nina was bandied around, like Dr. Nina Arif.
Because it's easier for other people to say.
You know, because everybody constantly wants to change you so it's easier for somebody else.
Preach!
Exactly. And so I and that's the other thing that I realised. You know, I was like, I got all my degrees. You know, that's what I like. I played the game. I did what you wanted. I got the degrees. I got the titles. And now I'm a bit much. And now my name is a bit much. You know, I had a consultant at hospital when I was a junior doctor who said to me, we talk about institutionalized racism, but medical school was your first sort of spotlight into it because my name has always been a bit too much. And she said to me, she's a white consultant. And she just said, looked at the name on the thing and she said, I can't pronounce your name. So I'm just going to call you Nicola. And I went, that's not my name. And I had this courage at the time when I was a medical student. I must have been like a fourth year medical student. And I just had this courage amongst all these other doctors and just said to her, that is not my name. My name is Nigat and I want you to learn it. And she just looked at me like really shocked. But actually, there's always been something inside me that's sort of said, I'm going to stand up for myself because everybody else gets too embarrassed to stand up for yourself. And when you're trying to go into a new realm and going into media, so far away from my day-to-day job. I mean, I'm slogging it as a GP and seeing patients, and that's my comfort zone. And then suddenly to be in the media, like doing stuff like podcasts, this is not my thing. Mm-hmm. It's new things that you, and then you want to fit in and not stand out, but you have to have the courage to say, no, I'm not going to change my name, especially a name that your parents gave you.
Oh, so emotional. I feel like I'm literally just like, I love you. I think I'm in love with you. I'm like, this is like such an amazing personality trait to be this strong. And like, this is everything I hope for, to inspire other people to be like this, because we don't see it enough. You don't hear it enough. And that's why when people sit on the sofa and they tell me an empowering story, I just start crying because I'm just like, oh, it's so amazing. But there, you know, the point around not too much, I think I learned very recently, it's never that I'm too much. It's that you're not enough. Mm-hmm. And there's this quote in Crazy Rich Asians that the girl says, I love her, I can't remember her name. And she said to her husband when he was cheating on her, she was like, you think I hide my things? I hide my things from you because you can't accept it. Mm. And like, you can't take it. But she said, it's not my job to make you a man and to make you feel manly enough.
Yeah,
I cannot make you something that you're not. And it's the same when people say you're a bit too much. It's like, you're not enough.
Yeah.
And you can't accept it. It doesn't mean I need to bring myself down or minimize what I'm doing because you can't accept it with an open heart of what I'm doing. Right? And so many of us are trying to fit ourselves into these boxes, but our box is bigger. And either you accept it or you don't. But I'm not going to minimize myself because you can't accept who I am.
I think that's so beautiful. That is so beautiful. And that's why I've come to full circle now.
But you've always been like that. That's why I think it's so amazing.
But I never knew that I was like that at the time. At the time, I was shitting myself constantly. I was like, oh my God, this consultant's going to now downgrade me, or she's not going to grade me appropriately. Or the fact that, you know, my name is complicated. You know, my name actually means something amazing. I hated my name with vengeance. My sister is called Subba and she's got such a beautiful name, and I was like, why didn't you give me such a nice and easy name?
You have a lovely name.
But Nighat means in Arabic Najat, and it means rescuer. So on the day of judgment, when humanity is broken, you want Najat to come and save humanity, which is really beautiful. Fitting. And I never even knew I was going to be a doctor. And so I think that when you have such an incredible name, it takes time sometimes to learn it because it just doesn't fit that Western aesthetic. But actually, I found the courage always because I had no one else behind me. I have a mother who doesn't speak English at all still. Wow. My father, who is working in the mosque and you know, his life is given to his congregation, and rightly so. And I have no other family in the UK. They're all in Pakistan still, apart from my husband, who's now here with me. And so I had to be strong. And I was going, defied isn't the right word, but I went against what my parents had hoped for, which was to get me married off and to say, no, I'm going to go off and do medicine for 5 years and I'll be back when I'm 23. So we had a deal, you know, hold off my marriage until I'm 23 and then we'll talk about marriage then. And then I came back after my medical degree and I said, actually, yeah, let's let's go and get married. And I hadn't found anybody.
Okay.
So my parents were like, they did the whole sort of suitors and, you know, chaperone dating sort of malarkey.
So you met him before? It wasn't like you just had to meet him, had to marry him?
Khalid is my best friend. I knew he was 7 years old when my parents got married. He's about 9 years older than me.
Okay.
And so he has always known my family. So I grew up in Tatti Fateh in Pakistan, and he came from Jalias. So we're basically, he's village 42, I'm village 38.
Okay.
And so that's how we've known, we go back generations. And he taught me how to climb trees and everything.
Oh, amazing.
And so he
you
went
knew
off.
Him. Yeah.
I knew him through that. He was always my friend, but never romantically. And he won't mind me telling you this because we say it to each other. It was never this, we love each other and we're passionate about each other. I think it took us about 3 years into our marriage to go, oh, actually, we can tolerate each other.
Really?
And now we're in there was this moment where I was like, oh, okay, I think I love you. And
I love that. So you think you can learn to love? You don't need to be instantly in love with someone?
I never loved, he never loved me though when we got married. We just were best friends and we could get on with each other and never get bored in each other's company.
Okay.
And so have conversations. So he was actually a friend before, like we had, and a part of me just, I needed somebody who would be strong enough to put up with all the rubbish that I deal with in medicine, and also him as a lawyer, and somebody who basically wouldn't leave me. That sounds really bad, doesn't it?
Well, look, I think we're sold this idea of romance as you meet someone, you have butterflies, and you're with them forever. But what you're saying is you can learn to love.
Yeah, but I would say I still don't get butterflies. I mean, we've been married 17 years.
Yes. So you define love in a different way.
Yeah, I think for us, it's, for me, I respect him deeply, and he respects me deeply, and I see him, he sees me as his equal.
Okay.
And so we sort of give each other time every evening to go through things, and I it's companionship, actually.
Okay.
It's more than that, because I think that sort of butterflies and that sort of instant spark, I believe, and I might be wrong because I haven't felt it, but I believe that dies. I don't think that stays forever, especially as you get older and older. We've been sort of together for 17 years. And
yes.
I'm not saying we have the perfect marriage. Like every relationship has its ups and downs, and we have misunderstandings and we fight and things like that. But he never sort of had on his sort of list that his wife was going to end up being on TV, you know, every week. And
your mom was probably like, oh my God.
Recognized
on
the streets. And so you need someone strong enough who's able to deal with the ups and downs and to deal with sort of a very sick child with you and stand by you side by side to make the decisions of a liver transplant and how much rounds of chemo we're going to do.
How is your son now?
He's amazing. He's so good. He's 8 years old and he's just recently discovered why he has a huge scar on his belly because he goes swimming and things. And he's just been lovely. In fact, yesterday I took him for his blood test because he goes every 3 months for a blood test. And he walked up to the nurse and he put his arm out and he was like, I'm ready for my blood test. And I was just like so proud of him.
So sweet.
So it's like now I feel this is in my 40s. I'm finally trying to thrive. Whereas before it was always survival.
You are thriving. And I feel like I need to thrive. And the only way I'm going to thrive is if I have the knowledge.
Yes.
So I knew this was going to happen. I always do this. I'm always like, I want to know about your life. And actually, I think that was the most amazing, empowering part of a podcast I've ever done. I really love your story. And I think that, look, you talk about female health all the time. If people want to know about female health, they can go to your platform and you can learn about it.
Yeah.
But what people need to know is that there is hope. And I do believe in kismet.
Yeah, I do, totally.
Kismet is destiny. And I believe that we all have a destiny. And just how you said that you knew that you were destined for more.
Yeah.
You're living that life. Whether the scale of it, I think it depends on how hard you work, for sure.
Yeah.
But I believe that you were put on this planet to be more than just a wife.
Oh, like, that's so kind.
And no, but like, see, you think that's so kind of me to say, but like, that's actually like, it's crazy, right? That like that's what you were told. Like that is your purpose to be a wife.
Yeah.
And it is part of your purpose because you love your husband and you love your kids. And me saying that doesn't take away from that fact. But a lot of people will watch this and be like, oh no, you both hate your husbands and you're both feminists and like you hate men. It's like, well, we don't. We just believe we have bigger purposes in life, and that's to help others too.
Yeah, I agree.
Right?
And it actually, if I come to my book, the reason I wrote my book, weirdly enough, was not for women. I wrote my book completely for my sons and my husband.
Yeah.
Because, so this took me about 10 years, not to write down for 10 years, but it's 10 years of my clinical knowledge that I've accumulated in a book, and it's fully illustrated.
I know that.
Because you were shocked when you first saw the pictures. Right. You were like, what?
When Dr. Niggert gave me this book, did I say your name right now?
Yeah, you have.
I opened the book and I came to this page and I was like, oh my God. And I shut the book and I was like,
she did. And you were like, she's got stretch marks.
And I actually was like, oh my God, it's brown, which I've never seen before, right? Because we always see like a pink vagina, or I don't know what this is called, a womb, a vulva, whatever. Vulva. I don't know anything, okay? I actually fell asleep probably in sex ed because I didn't even know about hymen the other day. My friend had to tell me about that. No, honestly, I don't know how I've survived in life, really. But I remember you pointed out that you put stretch marks on here, you put, you know, hair on here, because we don't see that.
No.
We see a Western vulva and we think that all vulvas look this. But like, this was actually very interesting. I remember you said your mum was mortified when she saw this.
Yeah, she was absolutely mortified.
I was mortified as well. I was like, oh my God, what is this?
She's actually really conservative, guys.
I am actually quite conservative. I have realised that. But, you know, I want to talk around, and also, you know, there's a lot of illustration in here, which I really loved. I mean, things around, you know, discharge and showing the colours of the vaginal discharge and what they mean. And, you know, the reason I think it's so important you've written this book, The Knowledge, we are not knowledgeable.
Yeah.
Why?
There's so many different reasons why. One is that, so if you talk about just the fact that our own body and our anatomy, it's never ours. So we're not taught enough about it. So if you look at the school curriculum, and hats off to all the teachers, because honestly, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for my teachers. But there's only certain levels of education that they have that then they give to the students. And it's up to the students to take that on board. And you're at that age where you're not going to take it on board. And so also the whole thing about it is the fear of, I'm going to fall pregnant and I need to know how not to fall pregnant, and how can I just mop up this period blood that I get every sort of 4 weeks and deal with that. And I think that the actually understanding your body and appreciating your body, there's a lot of shame attached to that. Then if you go to the second bit, which is cultural barriers, so there are so many I'm Punjabi and I speak Punjabi at home. There are so many words that we don't have for our body either. So we don't have words for vulva apart from swear words, or breast word is chati, which isn't actually, you know, the word for breast.
No, that's chest, isn't it?
Exactly. So how do you explain things? I've got a picture of a model of gynecological womb, ovaries and fallopian tubes. And
even
all
everyone.
The bits of all of that, we're not taught of all the anatomical bits of what everything is. And so how do you understand what you want to explain? Or if things go wrong, exactly like you said, how do I know what's the vulva and how do I know what
bit is vagina? If you paid me £10 million right now, I wouldn't be able to tell you what the parts are, which is shocking.
We can go quickly through that.
Yeah, tell me, what's this?
So that's the fimbriae. That's the fimbriae at the end where your ovaries would be sitting next to. But yeah, so that's attached to the long tube that goes into the fallopian tube.
So, which is not on here.
Which is behind there.
Okay, here.
There, that's it. That's the fallopian tube.
Oh, I did think this was a fallopian tube.
Yeah, it is. But the little
1 point to me, £1 million you have to pay me.
So the little flowery bits at the front are called fimbriae. So they're the little sort of fingers that attract the egg from the ovary, which is underneath it. So you can see that grey one, that's the ovary. And that ovary has got little lumps in it because it's trying to represent what cysts might look like if it was an ovary with issues with it. And then you go round to the top. So that bump is now your uterus. So that's called the head of the uterus up there. And that is the bit that you can feel in your stomach. And then you go down the other side and that's your next fallopian tube. And that's it. So that fallopian tube is inflamed and that's your ovary as well. So on one side it's closed and the other side you see.
Oh, okay.
And so you've got two ovaries. And then as you go down to the middle, that's your whole uterus. So the inside is your womb. And then go down a little bit and there. So that where your finger is the opening of the neck of the womb. It's known as the cervix. So there's
so that really low down now?
Yeah, so that's okay. Really low down. And then the following down that hold the rings, that's all your vagina. So your vagina is a tube that can extend. And also your cervix, so the neck of the womb, can open up to about 10 centimetres. Okay. So that, because if remember, if you have a baby in the middle, in the inside, then it has to come out of the cervix, and the cervix can expand to about 10 centimetres. And so your vagina is also an expandable sort of tissue. It's mucosal tissue, which produces its own lubrication and also protection. It's got lovely immune system sitting there. And then at the outside bit would be your vulva. So your vulva would be your lips, your labia majora, your labia minora. And
where
so they're
that?
The bits that
here
you would see.
Or here?
No. So it'll be at the end, yeah.
So is this where your tummy is?
So that's where your tummy is.
This expands and you push the baby out from here.
Yeah, that's it. See? You do know loads of stuff.
I mean, I'm like, which end is my stomach? Honestly, people on this podcast be like, you're so dumb. But I didn't learn. I wasn't listening in school. How was I learning?
I hate this sort of analogy that you're so dumb and you don't know. Look, you only know what you know. And even though I've written the knowledge, there's so much stuff that even I don't know as a doctor. And we're constantly learning and evolving being. The number one always thing is just never be embarrassed to ask. That's the most important thing. So a lot of my social media that I make on TikTok and Twitter and, you know, Reels and etc. The reason I started doing that is because how do you know if we as doctors don't impart what we learn to the general public?
Okay.
You know, if I'm sitting in my consultation room, I'm seeing one patient for 10 minutes. But then on social media, as you know, you can teach 60 million.
Yes.
You know, because that's the hits that she gets.
Manifesting. I do not get 60 million, but okay.
But like that's the kind of access that you've given. And then think about all the people that you might have saved from going to their doctor because actually you've reassured them.
Yes.
Or you've highlighted something that they're like, I would have never have thought that was abnormal. Now I will go to my doctor. So I think that's the beauty of why sharing what you know. And I read somewhere that, you know, your knowledge is each of us carry a candle and it's unlit from the moment we're born because none of us are born with any knowledge. We are blank slates. But if you think of it, you carry a candle with you. Then one person learns that knowledge. And all they have to do is tip their candle and light the other person. And if you keep on doing that, you literally light the knowledge in every person. Wow. And that would be the most beautiful thing that you could give. And it's the greatest gift that you could give. So let people light their candles with your knowledge.
I love that. I think it's so beautiful. I've never heard that before, so thank you. I hope that I do that with this podcast because I feel like you're teaching me and then I'll teach someone else and we're teaching everyone at home. I want to talk about female health and, you know, some of the common misconceptions people have, some things people struggle with. You know, we don't know enough about our bodies. Well, I personally don't know enough about my body. And I do think that there are probably things that I'm missing because I just don't know what's right and what's wrong. So what are some of the key signs we miss and what are the consequences of not knowing?
So the biggest thing if you're looking at women's health is the fact that they don't know how to examine their vulva and their vagina. So that's the bits on the outside. Okay. And that is constantly changing. So you can pick up skin stuff. So there's a type of eczema that can happen around the vulva and the vagina called lichen sclerosis. And there's another type called lichen planus. But you only know that if you look and then share that. But also when it comes to mainstream sort of healthcare material, we don't have those pictures in black and brown skin. So what I try to do is that put that in the book because I see that in my surgery. Then the next thing I think that a lot of misconceptions is about our periods. Everybody assumes that we will all have perfectly normal periods. Once, you know, for 3 weeks, we have no periods and 1 week we bleed and it's only for 1 week and then it starts again and so forth until we're ready to have a baby. Actually, do you know what? That's a blessing if you have normal periods. You are
really?
Very lucky, yeah. My clinics are full of women who have polycystic ovary syndrome. So they have irregular, so that's a metabolic hormonal condition where they endocrinological condition where they end up getting changes in their testosterone and their estrogen and their progesterone. And so that actually gives them irregular periods. They might not have a period for 4 months. I also deal with endometriosis, which are cells similar to the lining of the womb, which grow outside into the womb, and that can give you painful, heavy periods. You might get adenomyosis, which are cells that grow into the muscular wall of the uterus. So again, to have no flooding. So I get some patients who come to my surgery and they say, when I'm on the day one or day two of my period, I stand up and it just gushes out of me. You know, wow. It's a blessing if you don't have that.
Of course.
And so the majority of my work as a doctor, I would say 80%, is just dealing with problematic periods. So we take that myth away to say that everybody's normal. No, everybody isn't normal. And nobody asks each other. Like, we tell each other, oh, how's the weather? How are you? In fact, I've now started asking women, so how are your periods? My mates as well. Because if you ask them, you normalize that bit of you. But also, that's a big part of their life that they are probably struggling with. And it's something that we shouldn't be using as derogatory, oh, she's on a period. Then lastly, I think the thing that we don't talk about with women's health is the fact that we still don't tell each other enough that our ovaries are intrinsically linked with the function of our brain. Did you know that?
Yeah. No. What does that mean?
So there is something called the multiple hormone sensitivity theory. And this theory has been around for quite a while, but it's not in the mainstream and not many people know about it. So the function of your hormones, so particularly estrogen and progesterone and a little bit of testosterone, we now know, and it's been scientifically proven, that it changes how nerve endings talk to each other in our brain. Isn't that crazy? So women for like decades have been saying, but I get like loss of words or brain fog. Just before my periods, I get really angry, Dr. Arif, or I get really irritable, or like me, I get really clumsy. The number of cars I've scratched, and I've told my husband, it's because I was on my period.
No way.
Yeah, we lose our spatial awareness. I dropped my mum's expensive vase and it was just like, oh, I'm about to start my period. And like we get irritable. Our relationship, the way we talk to our loved ones, changes just before our period.
I'll either cry hysterically or I'll get really angry. One of the two.
So there is a real reason why that happens, because when estrogen decreases, it changes the way the nerve endings and the synapses talk to each other in our brain neurologically. So that means that your cortisol hormone, which is your stress hormone, increases. So no wonder you cry.
I'm either very emotional and I'll be like, I'm obviously going to stop my period in one day because I'll just cry for no reason hysterically, or I'll get really angry and I'll say, I'm really sorry, I think I might start my period. And then my partner will be like, no, well, if you don't, then you're being ridiculous. And then I'll start and I'll be like, see, I told you. And he'll be like, oh my God.
You see, classic. You knew this. Yeah. And we've been saying, but you know, medically, we've been gaslighting women for ages and saying, yeah, it's all in your head. Stop being hysterical. That's not true. And it is absolutely true. The multiple hormone sensitivity theory has proven that our brain actually changes neurological pathways within the hormones from our ovaries changes the neurological pathways within our brain.
Wow.
And that is the crazy, amazing thing about women. This is why women are so beautiful. The fact that our brains are so intrinsically linked with our gynecologically. And we just don't trust women enough to be able to sort of say to them, yeah, you are right.
Yes.
You know, it's like no shit show. Like we've been saying for ages that we get irritable before our period. But now science has caught up to say, yeah, women were right. Which leads me on to the last myth, is that women don't know their bodies. I'm telling you right now, women do know about their bodies. Trust your body, listen to your body, keep a track of all your symptoms, because you will know your body the best. And what my job as a clinician always, I say, is to just listen to women, because they actually give me the diagnosis just by talking to me and telling me, because they come in and go, I have all these symptoms. I just have to piece that together. So trust women.
I love that.
And believe women.
I think that, you know, I remember speaking to someone else about this and said that when women come in and they say their symptoms, it's always like, oh, you're hysterical, you're making it up, like you'll get over it. But, you know, the reason why so many women go undiagnosed is because doctors don't believe them.
Yeah. And it's not just doctors. Society doesn't. So I'll give you an analogy. On average, the 11-year-old girl starts bleeding. That's a national average. I mean, you can get 10-year-old girls who start having a period. Now, at the age of 11, she'll have two or three periods and she'll know that she'll get irritable and mood-related symptoms, or she might get painful periods. So at the age of 11, girls know the game. Mm. You know, they know how to play the game. They know. You ask an 11-year-old boy, do you get pain every 3 weeks? They'll be like, no. Their lived in experience of their body means that they don't get those changes and those fluctuations. They might be going through the changes for puberty, but that's separate. But The fact that 11-year-olds and 12-year-olds know how to play the game around pain and how to manage that, and they do that consistently, how can we be in a society where culturally we still say they're the weaker sex and we downplay their symptoms constantly? Mm. But that's the gender bias that we've got, right? That's the blindness that we have into how powerful women's bodies are, because their purpose, we come back to that conversation from the beginning, is to, well, just to bear us children and have babies. Your purpose is to get married, and that's your reproductive health is your only purpose.
How do we change that?
So many ways. So firstly, it is to have these conversations like this, to empower women to know their anatomical bits, because when you know your anatomical bit, you know how to manage that with a doctor. And then doctors need to be able to listen to women consistently and say, no, you are absolutely the person that's right. The majority of the time, I say to my patients in my surgery, just to validate them. So validation is where we change it. Believe women, validate what they're saying. Their lived-in experience is absolutely right, but their lived-in experience will be nuanced.
Okay.
As a South Asian woman who's Punjabi and Pakistani, I will not have the same lived-in experience as a black woman. I love black women and I treat a lot of black women, and I know that they have their own struggles and their own cultural pathways and genetic issues as well, which can cause them to have, we think, higher rates of fibroids. So that's another condition. So fibroids are non-cancerous growth that happen in the womb. And so do not be voices for black women, unless you're a black woman, because they are the people that they should be leading the war. And I think this is the other thing that happens. So how do we change that?
Mm.
And you said, well, actually, we never need to be saviors for other people. You know, a white woman will never be able to understand the struggles I have as a Pakistani Punjabi woman, a Muslim woman who wears hijabs. So I don't need a savior, a white savior, to come and help me. I, as a Punjabi Muslim woman, don't need to be a savior for black women and so forth. What we should be doing is allowing and amplifying these voices and pulling them up to the table and pulling a chair out for them and saying, right, you are validated. I need to learn from you. So, that's how you change it.
But why are we not doing that?
Racism, barriers of poverty, institutionalized sexism. We have internalized misogyny. Women just can't support women, unfortunately.
Yeah.
We still have that. And then research. We don't research different women from different ethnicities enough, because the money, it's not sexy.
You want to
have a cardiology and then the newfangled technology for the heart because that's sexy.
Yeah.
And what's so sexy about listening to women and their period pain, because everybody gets that. And I think finally we've got to come to a conclusion that it only changes if we wanted to change as women and not rely on men to make the changes for us. Inform men, but we have to be able to say as women collectively, actually, that they're great as supporters out there, but we just need them as allies and to support them. And I say this as a mother of three boys. And so I'll give you a really quick example. I did a workshop in my town, in Chesham, on contraception. And I had all the Pakistani ladies who came, and I was talking about contraception. I was saying, look, for contraception, it's not just the pill or the mini pill. You've got the implant. You've got condoms. You've got the injection, the Depo-Vera injection. You've got coils, which are copper coils, and then marina coils, ones that stop your periods, one that don't stop your periods. You can have a vaginal ring. You can have a patch. You can have femidoms, so women can have condoms as well. So I did this whole, and I was really proud of myself. And I was like, and these were really educated women. You know, one was a lawyer, one was working in an office. So, you know, quite well to do. English was not an issue. There were some women in the group for whom English was not their first language. And at the end of it, the women just went, I'm going to go home and talk to my husband about this and then decide. And whatever he says is what I'll do. And I couldn't believe it. And then it realized, actually, the battle has always been is that we as women, we're invested, we know. But we haven't educated the men in our lives to be able to do that, because sharamatiye, you know, parde de niche rakho, is we're embarrassed, keep this thing under the carpet.
Yes.
And so the conversation only starts when we blur those lines, and men are very much part of the conversation. So you ask, you know, why aren't we having that? It's because we're not making books for men.
Mm.
Like, this is a book for men. This is a book for my boys. Because my boys will have daughters one day. They'll get married if they want to get married. They'll have children if they want to have children. and their own mother will get old and she'll be heading towards her menopausal years. So for them to understand me, it has to start with me as a woman teaching my boys in my house about me.
Yes.
We don't teach them. We teach them everything else. We teach them how to pray. We teach them how to, you know, behave in public. But as women in the house, we don't teach our fathers and our sons and our daughters, you know, even our sisters, brothers, cousins about us. So actually that sort of, there are more conversations that are happening. There are families who are really open and they are having those conversations and I applaud that. But I think that we need a lot more of that because consistently what happens is we're having the same rat race again and again. So I always constantly get asked, you know, Dr. Nagat, you know, for goodness sake, stop banging on about women's health. Why are you talking about women's health? You've got four sons. Why are you doing it? And I've got a quote on my wall. I feel like this podcast is turning into a lot of quotes, but
I love it.
There's a writer and a poet called Colleen Hoover, who actually, if you read a lot of her poetry now, I, with my women's health hat on, is thinking, I think she probably had endometriosis. But she writes the fact that, you know, women's pain and how we carry pain from childbirth to breastfeeding, and then we do it all over again for the next child, and then we hit the menopause. And so she wrote, my grandmother went through pain, my mother went through pain, I'm going through pain, and I'll be damned if my daughter goes through pain. And that sticks with me constantly. And to the point where I've got to the point where I'll be like, I'll be damned if my sons don't know about my pain.
Mm. Everything you said throughout this podcast is just so empowering. It feels like you have this incredible energy and force within you that you, I believe that is your purpose. Like from a young age, you knew that this was you. I feel like this is so serendipitous as you're telling me. I'm like, you are, whatever you had within you is like, so strong. It makes me believe so much more in that we all have a purpose on this earth, because that girl that was like, I'm going to go to London, I'm going to do this interview and I'm going to go against everyone else, and like now, you know, I'm going to put these pictures of, you know, a vulva in here and I'm going to make sure there's stretch marks and there's hair and you're going to be brown representation.
And you know, different sized bodies. None of my models in there are slim. I don't have a thigh gap, and I was like, I want to have a, you know, a postnatal body. A postnatal body is not flat. Like you don't ping back.
Yes.
By the way, just so you know, nobody pings back. That I need to get rid of that myth straight away.
Yeah,
you know, you have a belly. I mean, my belly is still there after my son is five. Yeah. That's still my pregnancy belly. But you need to sort of change that narrative of what normal is and own it as much as possible. And I suppose that's that we've just skewed everything so much in different ways.
Mm.
And then in the middle of that, you're just thinking,
where do I fit in?
Where do I fit in? Yeah.
Well, I'm just so grateful we had this conversation. I feel like it was so empowering. I feel like we need to do another one because I really need a sex ed lesson, honestly. I'm going to read the book in detail. I've obviously looked over it, but I think that, you know, if you need to start somewhere, I think it would be to start, you know, figuring out what it is for yourself. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for writing this book.